Hello and welcome to the RVC podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. Only 4 days after this summer's foot and mouth outbreak had officially been declared as contained, a neighbouring region of rural Surrey has been struck by a new outbreak of this much feared animal disease. Foot and mouth disease is a disease which affects sheep, cattle and pigs and is caused by the foot and mouth disease virus, a virus which is so dangerous because in our climate, the virus can persist in the environment for a long time and the small size of the virus particles facilitates the rapid spread of the disease. Despite the fact that foot and mouth disease poses no threat to human health, animals infected with the virus suffer heavily from severe clinical symptoms including lameness, turning the disease into an animal welfare problem as much as an economical threat to the affected farms and the economy as a whole. Because so far, no effective treatment for foot and mouth disease is available, and prophylactic vaccinations show little promise, the veterinary authorities have focused on strategies that keep the UK livestock free from the disease, or do everything to limit outbreaks like the current one. In order to look into this issue in more detail, we will take the opportunity to talk to Professor Brian Aldridge about the problem that foot and mouth disease presents to the animals affected, to the UK farming industry and the UK economy as a whole, and also about how the strategies to fight the disease have changed since the 2001 outbreaks.
Well, thank you, Brian, for joining us here today. The questions I wanted to ask you about foot and mouth disease is, first of all, why are veterinarians and why is the public so concerned about the disease? What do the clinical symptoms of the disease look like and what makes it so important in the livestock industry?
It's an interesting virus. Probably the most important aspect of it is the rapidity which it spreads through an infected population. So if one animal gets it, depending on the species of animal, that it can spread through a population very, very quickly. So the effects that you see aren't just limited to a single animal. It can affect a population very rapidly, as we've seen in the outbreaks in this country in the last few years. The clinical signs depend a lot on the species that it's infected with it, and that drives in some way control policies. With cattle, generally, it infects an epithelial surface, so a surface such as the respiratory tract or into the buccal cavity. So once the virus gets through the surfaces, the lining of the mouth or the respiratory tract, it spreads around the body, the virus gets into the bloodstream, it's called a viremia, and then it sort of lands in other tissues such as in the feet or in the mammary gland. It gives lesions on skin surfaces. In cattle, that's what you'd see. You'd see these classic vesicles, usually on the feet. You might see the animal slobbering or salivating because of the lesions, which tend to be like mouth ulcers, open sores, really, in those surfaces. In pigs, you'd see a similar thing. One of the first things you'd see would be a sort of a sudden onset of lameness. So you might go into a group of pigs and see a lot of pigs lying down. And it can be so painful that they'll be reluctant to rise. And same again in sheep. One of the first signs is lying down and a reluctance to rise. So you might go out into a group of animals and just as you approach them, they want to lie down because it can cause painful lesions. And then as you got closer and you opened their mouths, you'd see sores and ulcers in their mouth as well. And that would give you a clue that it was a systemic viral infection that was affecting multiple surface or epithelial tissues.
And the incubation period of that disease is very short as well.
Yeah, just
contributing to the speed of spread of the disease, is that right?
Exactly. Just a few days. If you get one animal that's infected, the virus that it's shedding can cause clinical signs in other animals within 2 to 3 days. It can be very rapid indeed, yeah.
So beyond the economical concerns which there are associated with a foot and mouth disease outbreak, because after all, the production of those animals will go down, and that's why the farming industry is so concerned about it. There are certainly also animal welfare concerns associated to an outbreak of foot and mouth disease. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's a very good question, really, because if you saw an outbreak, if you saw animals that were infected, if you went past a field or you went into a shed where animals had foot and mouth disease, I think you'd be struck by the severity of the disease, the pain they were in, the discomfort they were in by the lesions. You can imagine what a mouth ulcer feels like. They can be so severe that the animal won't eat. And because it's a viral infection, we don't really have good treatment modalities at all. So if I go and see an animal with another kind of lameness, an ulcer in its foot from another cause, I can treat that. I can bandage it. I can put medication on it. If I have a lameness caused by foot and mouth virus, I don't have drugs or chemicals that can actually kill that virus. And by definition, it's systemic viral infection, so it can affect multiple aspects of the body. So basically, you'd have to wait for the disease to be self-limiting, if it was self-limiting. And some of our animals, because of the physiological status they're in, because of the way they're used for production, it can cause quite long-term illness in them as well. And some of those animals you would want to euthanize because of the severity of the disease and the pain and suffering that they were going through. So it's certainly not just an economic problem. It's a big welfare issue in the animals that are infected as well.
So based on what you told us before, we now know that it's quite a severe disease and animals are going to suffer, and at the other end of the stick, basically the economy is going to suffer from an outbreak as well. So what does the UK government plan to do in case of an outbreak, if there was a more severe outbreak than the one we've seen in Pirbright in Kent recently?
A lot of the prevention and the control of the spread comes from the activities and the actions of the person who first identifies it. So if you went to a field and you suspected a cow or a sheep or a pig had foot and mouth disease, you would be advised to stay with that animal straight away and contact the local government office, even if you thought it could be another disease as well, because the implications of missing an infected animal are quite severe because it spreads so quickly. So you would stay with that animal, you would contact the local divisional veterinary service, and they would come out quite quickly. But in the meantime, you would prevent any animal movement or people movement on your farm, because that's the major cause of spread, would be either aerosol from the animal, and if there was a strong wind, that aerosol can spread virus to other animals or other farms. As far as tens of kilometres away, we've had it sort of cross parts of the ocean through aerosol infection as well. So to stay on that premises, put up signs to limit access to the farm straight away. The divisional veterinary manager would send somebody out there straight away, and either on clinical signs, on the suspicion of clinical signs, put a movement order on that farm, or quickly collect samples for further analysis. And the government then, as soon as there was a confirmed case though, they would put a sort of national ban on livestock, and they put a control zone around those premises. So, and the veterinary inspector does that, it's called a protection zone that they put around the place of around 3 kilometres. And then all the animals in that area become inspected by veterinary inspectors to see if there's any more animals on that premises or farms within that 3 kilometre radius. And then there's a surveillance zone of about 10 kilometres put around the infected premises. And within that area, there's stricter biosecurity and movement restrictions than in other areas of the country, even though there would be a national ban. And then on that farm, there'd be a culling of the infected animals, animals with confirmed disease, but also those that were at risk of getting the infection as well. But the farmer wouldn't have to accept personal losses for that. Those animals would be valued, and the farmer would receive compensation for the animals that were culled in that area. And then the carcasses had to be dealt with, though. They'd have to be incinerated or processed so that they couldn't be a source of infection locally either. And then certain disinfections protocols get put in place as well. So disinfection barriers get placed around that farm or in that premises, as well as spraying and decontamination of the farm premises, because the virus is known to be already present. And then international trade is affected. So there'd be an announcement that the country had foot and mouth, and there wouldn't be any export of animals or animal products for at least 3 months from the final outbreak.
So there is essentially a local response upon suspicion of foot and mouth disease, but as soon as the disease would be confirmed, these implications would be wide, and there, for example, would be a nationwide ban of animal transportation, or at least of farm animals, as far as I'm aware.
Exactly. For the point of identification of that infected animal or that diseased animal, there could have been multiple movements of virus-contaminated material, either the animals, other animals, secretions from that animal, people, or products such as farm vehicles that contain viral particles. That could have taken place in the 2 or 3 days leading up to the identification of that animal. So the spread might already have taken place. In fact, it's likely to have done, even at the point of identification of that animal. Hence the the surveillance zone and the protection zone. And by examining all the movement records, the government veterinary inspectors can identify other areas that might have received contaminated material. And there a massive process of surveillance will take place. So if animals have moved to another part of the country, those animals would be tested for the presence of infection straight away. So because we have a national recording system of animal movement, we can now trace where every animal from within that area had gone to.
Over a certain period of time.
And you have to look at the weeks preceding that infection, because you want to trace the source of where that infection had come from. And maybe multiple animals have been exposed to that source of infection as well.
So I suspect that all these policies have changed quite drastically after the outbreak in 2001. And is that probably also the reason why the recent outbreak in Kent probably, well, as far as we're aware at the moment, was possible to be contained?
No, exactly. When an outbreak has taken place, there's a huge amount of research that goes on within the outbreak and following the outbreak to correct any errors, but to drive policy in preventing such a scenario happening again. So, for instance, in this last outbreak, movement restrictions were put in place very, very quickly, within just a few hours of identifying the infected animal. And because of that, that was one of the aspects of the control, was very effective. Whereas in the previous outbreak, it was a number of days before movement restrictions were put on the premises, because it took a while to identify the infected animal. And within those few days, animals had already moved around the country, and there was already a national outbreak was underway. But so just the difference of instituting even national movement and those biosecurity protocols that I mentioned before could be the difference between it being locally confined or spreading around the country. And also the research that's taken place, there's research taken place as far as simulated models as to what will happen in any outbreak. We now understand a little bit more about how the weather could affect it. So, and because these models are in place, we can insert data that's collected from that day as to what the weather conditions are like, what the animal movement is. Even if it starts in a pig as opposed to it starts in a cow, that's likely to change the characteristics of the outbreak that takes place following that, because pigs secrete a lot more virus than cows would, for instance. The animals in the local region, there's been a lot of research into susceptibility of different species. Cows can be infected with a lot smaller dose than it would take to infect a pig. Therefore, if the outbreak farm was surrounded by dairies in close proximity, then the propagation of the infection is going to be a lot quicker than if it was pig farms or sheep flocks, or if it was an urban area as well. So all those facts can be put into a model, and those models have been developed in the wake of the outbreaks we've had, and now predict the likelihood of certain preventative procedures working or not working, and even it can be used to some degree to inform and drive the decision-making process. Though the models obviously aren't perfect, every outbreak's a bit different, and we're gathering new data all the time to make those models more robust. But some people have criticized the models, and then they're certainly not exact replicas. They're just meant to simulate what we expect to happen if all conditions met the criteria that was entered into the model.
So, at least if there was one positive thing about the outbreak in 2001, then that's the fact that we have better models now, is that right?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, there were massive economic losses, and more importantly, some of the emotional anguish that took place to the people losing so many animals, and that's always regrettable, isn't it? But you always hope that there is a benefit to future generations that come out, and I think the information that's arisen since then has been very useful in driving new policies, I think, and funding new research, identifying areas that we have been ignorant of before, and therefore driving the research based on those deficiencies in our knowledge from prior years.
You've mentioned the emotional issue which is attached to the culling of animals, which was the predominant response of the government to the outbreak in 2001. Has that changed for the future in any way? Do the agencies think in any other way about how to approach a future outbreak beyond the local restrictions to transport, for example? So is vaccination for the future a possibility?
Yeah, I certainly think there's two aspects really to the spread of any infectious disease and the control of that spread. One is reducing the number of animals that are shedding significant amount of viruses. The other one is controlling the access of that virus or virus contaminated material to other animals. So hence the term biosecurity, making areas biologically secure and stopping viral movement out of those infected areas. The other approach could be that you improve or increase the immunity of animals that would be exposed to that virus, and that's where vaccination comes in. And vaccination's been used successfully in a number of disease outbreaks in other countries, such as in the Netherlands and in Uruguay in 2000. And so some people have used that as evidence to say that vaccination can solve all our problems, whereas really that's not true. All the vaccine does is increases the immune response of an animal to that infection. It doesn't stop it getting the infection. So for instance, let's say a non-vaccinated animal shed 1,000 particles, 1,000 viral particles in an hour. A vaccinated animal will shed a huge amount less, maybe 10 particles of virus per hour, but it wouldn't not shed. Similarly, it still gets the disease, but it would get the disease in a lot lower level. So there's good implications for the virus as well. There's good welfare implications of using the vaccine as well. There are problems with it, but because of the new research that's taken place, they're less severe than before. And one of the problems was identifying a vaccinated animal and differentiating that from an animal that had a natural infection. Some of the diagnostic tests that we use wouldn't differentiate that. More recently, there's been diagnostic assays that have used different elements of the virus in the vaccine as opposed to from the natural infection. And to some degree, we can differentiate animals that have been vaccinated from those that have been exposed through a natural infection. So we can identify those animals. So that means vaccines can be used a lot more effectively, and we can satisfy international criteria as to be sure that the animals that we were exporting were vaccinated animals and not non-vaccinated animals. However, those diagnostic tests need a lot more refinement before they're accepted by the whole international community.
So there's progress at the moment, but before these progress will actually have effect in terms of policy with regards to foot and mouth disease, there will be some time and there will be some water running down the Thames, I suppose.
Exactly. There's different ways of using vaccination. I mean, you can, depending on the degree of the outbreak, there might be a situation in which the outbreak was so widespread that you wanted to, that you couldn't cull every animal in the country, therefore you wanted to limit suffering and limit the spread, and the culling wasn't being effective. Or your ability to remove infected carcasses was saturated, and so you had to have some other preventative measures, and therefore vaccination would come in. But even now, vaccination in an area would be considered a lot earlier in an outbreak than it was 6 or 7 years ago. So vaccination is certainly part of the government control strategy now. The other risk is, the other difficulty with vaccination is, how do you keep enough vaccine to vaccinate the massive number of animals that's needed? Especially, there's a lot of different strains or serotypes of virus, and depending on the type of virus that causes a particular outbreak, you might not have enough vaccine for that, to control that particular outbreak. So it's hard to keep vaccine stores of all the potential strains of virus that's needed. And therefore, and there's always a risk of that, as shown by the local outbreak. Whenever you work with the live virus, which
causes a risk as well,
there's a risk of an outbreak of a breakdown within the system that maintains the biosecurity of the premises that are working with it as well. That's always a risk of having a vaccine.
So this diversity and also this development of the foot and mouth disease virus is part of the reason why, potentially for the near future at least, vaccination will only be a means to probably contain an outbreak of the disease rather than being a strategy to eradicate the disease as a whole, is that right? Or to protect a whole population of animals from disease.
Exactly. There's enough variation between viral strains, even though they're from the same family, in essence. The surface proteins that they express are different enough between strains that protection against one won't guarantee protection against another one. Hence, the vaccines need to be tailor-made to some degree during that strain. But now with the new biological models and the rapid detection systems that we have that can type viruses very, very quickly, some of the molecular assays that are available, we can actually decide whether the vaccines that we have available would be appropriate in that particular outbreak. But there's no single answer to any one outbreak. You'd have to tailor make the preventative measures that were instituted depending on the nature of the virus, the type of virus, plus, as we said before, what animals it was in, what the weather was like at that time, and other factors as well that the models can help us factor into our preventative strategies.
So based on what you told us today, it would seem that we still have to be afraid and still have to try and prevent any future outbreak of the disease, but it would also seem that probably future outbreaks might have less severe implications on the UK farm animal population as a whole.
I think that's exactly right. It's great to have a foot and mouth free status, because that does mean that our animals don't suffer the welfare implications of having that disease endemic in the population.
At the same time.
Exactly. It helps trade, because we can export our products globally and help feed those countries that don't have access to the materials that we do here.
Well, thank you, Brian, for giving us such a comprehensive overview about the issue of foot and mouth disease.
Thank you, Matthias. Thank you.
That's it from the RBC podcast for this week. This episode was produced by me, Matthias Kleins, and Brian Cox. If you found this podcast informative, then please check our webpage again in 2 weeks' time or subscribe to the RBC podcast on iTunes. In the meantime, if you have any suggestions or feedback, please send it to podcast@rbc.ac.uk. Goodbye.